Early this year, the National Trust warned that the habitat of the great British eccentric is shrinking. One can now walk for miles along the highways and byways of this land without seeing a single loony or an Evelyn Waugh lookalike. The theory goes, like every theory today, that it's all due to the pressures of modern life. VAT has done for unconventional humans what DDT has done for over-elaborate butterflies. Hundreds of years of specialized evolution, clothing in defiance of the natural laws of the high street tailor, speech patterns which don't conform to school syllabuses, behavioral responses that would drive social scientists to suicide, all this, so it is said, is vanishing under the suede jackboot of modern monochrome man. And a nostalgic tear is shed for the demise of yet another great British institution. However, like most great British institutions, which we believe are much admired throughout the world, but which only the British have heard of, the eccentric is not exclusively our heritage. After all, why should genetics have conspired against Uruguayan unorthodoxy or Tanzanian quirkery? What is really happening is the decline here, there, and mostly everywhere, of eccentricity itself. And it's not just due to the EC regulations on standardization of behavior, which require one day a month of Italian hand-waving and one day a month of Gallic intellectual argument. Nor is it due to Orville and Wright, though the jet age does mean the world shares a common language in matters such as lost suitcases and venereal disease. The earth may be shrinking, but man's individuality is diminishing for other reasons. Firstly, in the Western world, real life is in short supply. Secondly, responses to it have a prearranged format. In the same way that supermarkets grade the vegetables so that you don't get shocked by an unusually shaped potato, so life itself goes through a sieve before it reaches us. Most of the nasty lumps never get to us, taken away by the likes of solicitors and public relations men and accountants and community health officers. Sabre-wielding Cossacks and plague victims and stampeding buffalo are at a premium in the average suburban crescent. Invisible forces are at work, sanitizing not only the telephones and the toilets, but the very life that is delivered to our doorsteps, free of germs and flooded roads and revolution. Dead sheep don't come out of taps, and private armies rarely camp in the garden. And one seldom has to reshoe one's yak personally. And if the peat makes your bothy stink, you can always take your peat receipt to the Consumer Affairs Office. Life used to be full of questions. For today's middle class, it is full of answers. For every crisis, there is an expert. For Mother Nature, red in tooth and claw, there is thermal underwear. For death itself, it is usually possible to arrange a deferral of several days. But just occasionally, the filter system of life breaks down, and great gobs of the real thing hit the fan. Suddenly, without even a formal application, one is held up or kidnapped in the first person, or engaged in a free-form discussion by an inner-city punk death squad. Now, we're all familiar with real-life drama and tension because we've seen it on television. And we all know, if faced with a psychopath or urban gorilla, exactly what the scriptwriter's correct response would be. We just have to hope that the psychopath or urban gorilla have seen the same program. And here we have a second reason why individuals, like chocolate bars, don't seem to come separately anymore, but in large uniform packs. Because our rare moments of personal and real crisis are the unending bread and butter of fictional broadcast, it is very hard to face an emergency without infinite déjà vus. We feel we have seen it all before, like one of those constantly reborn spiritualists who were big in ancient Egypt and other assorted civilizations. Except in our case, the previous performances are courtesy of J. Arthur Rank, and not the other almighty. If, for example, say, our partner requests a divorce, our linguistic freedom of movement is restricted, prescripted. Our emotional reactions are somehow predestined. An angry response is undercut by sudden memories of play for today. A quiet response is preempted by Kramer versus Kramer. And if we try a touch of pathos, Woody Allen taps us on the shoulder. Even our gestures have the feel of performance. We all know now how to turn away, choked, or exit dramatically. And if we cry, "I hate you, you bastard," there seems a strong chance a corporation lawyer will enter the room clutching a claim for infringement of copyright. These mass-produced scenarios are everywhere. Even small boys playing football in the park no longer score goals like small boys, but with all the formulaic panache of a match-of-the-day winner. And the developing countries, fed on a diet of insufficient vitamins and over-plentiful American gangster films, lack any resistant strain of sophistication. The wide boys of the third world behave like the extras of an unsuccessful Al Capone B-movie. In previous centuries, idiosyncrasies and eccentricities were individually patented, not modelled on J.R. prototypes and Starsky and Hutch hand-me-downs. Sociologists speak of received knowledge, but now we suffer from received lifestyles. Even death has its set formats, well tested by the ratings. Although we are unlikely to go, shot by the sheriff, most viewers of life manage to absorb a few standard expressions to adorn their death rattle. But it is vital to remember that old stars of stage and screen never die. They just live to play another role. In this respect, life rarely imitates art. This is an obscure but crucial subtlety for the 20th century mind. Otherwise, we could lie poised and ready with our deathbed quips and still be waiting for the Hollywood bowl violin section to cue us in when this mortal coil unceremoniously shuffles us off.